All right. We should have finished Henry, but we ran out of time. We got to finish up with the Anglican religion, and we got to deal with the Catholic Church's Counter-Reformation. Hi. How are you?
Good.
Oh, good. Man, we did not slam the door. All right. So I apologize. I was informed by the early comers that I did not open up your grades yet for exam two. Completely slipped my mind. I'll get on it. Probably tonight. Or if not tonight, I'll do it tomorrow. So you'll know before I see you again. But overall, the average was pretty good. So really, no one really should be freaking out about much of anything. All right. Papers. Throwing that out there just as a friendly reminder. April some point they're due. April 21st or something like that, if I remember correctly. I don't know. But it's out there. Don't forget, you have until the end of the month to get early submission bonus. But make sure you check proflamanic.com, the paper section, see how you're graded on, follow the directions, because this paper is less about your ability to write, but more about your ability to follow directions. So if you do not follow directions, you will fail the assignment. Do follow the directions, you should get a decent grade. All right. We left off with Henry deciding he wanted a divorce. Not that he was not a devout Catholic, but rather he put his family, his dynasty, ahead of his church. So when his lover, Anne Boleyn, had a bun in her oven because they didn't have ultrasounds and you couldn't determine if the baby had an innie or an outie, the king decided to break away from the universality of the Catholic Church, create his own church, make himself head of that church, so that way he would never have issues of annulments or divorces ever again. Now, interestingly enough, in the Anglican Church, divorce is allowed, whereas in the Catholic Church, it's death do you part. So, what would Henry do? Well, he would use his church to not have just one more wife, not just two more wives, but he would get married four more times, because each of his wives had issues. Catherine's issue was that she could no longer have babies, so kicked her to the curb. Sad story. He did let her live in a house, but he gave her limited funding. And I think it was 1536, she got ill and ended up dying, pretty much all alone. It was a very sad story. But he didn't care because he had his new plaything, Anne. Well, that was at least until Anne ran her usefulness out. Anne did give birth to Elizabeth, who survived, and she would get pregnant one more time and the child would be born stillborn, dead. After that, Henry's eyes started wandering again, and he became infatuated once more with another lady-in-waiting who he would want to hook up with. So in order to do so, he had to get rid of Anne. So Anne, in the end, would be found guilty of treason because it was alleged that she was an adulteress. She was accused of sleeping with not one, not two, but six men, including her own brother, incest. So she was put on trial, found guilty, and her head was cut off by a swordsman, not an axe. But by killing Anne, that paved the way for Jane Seymour. Now, according to all accounts, the king fell not in love. He lusted after Anne. But he absolutely fell in love with Jane Seymour. And apparently the love was shared. Jane managed to work reconciliation because back in these days, if you're going to get rid of a wife, you also have to disown your children. So he disowned Mary, his oldest child, as well as disowning Elizabeth. but Jane Seymour managed to bring the family together. She herself would eventually become pregnant, give birth to a son, Edward, which was what Henry wanted more than anything. But sadly, medical capabilities wasn't quite like it is to today, medical standards. And she would end up getting sick during the pregnancy, and she would die shortly after giving birth to Edward. Because back in those days, typically it was you either save the child or you save the woman. And Henry, as much as it broke his heart, decided to save his son. But he was once more a bachelor, so he decided to look out for another wife. His fourth wife, Anne of Cleves, was a political arrangement. Cleves was a German state, one of the German states that had adopted Calvinism, not Lutheranism, and his advisors suggested that he form this political alliance so that way he can have a connection with a state within the Holy Roman Empire. But the problem with marrying Anne was that she spoke German. She didn't speak any English. So Henry was sold and convinced based upon this portrait. And Anne of Cleves, very, very attractive woman, I think by modern standards. But when she arrived, she didn't quite look like the portrait. So Henry found her ugly. In fact, he described her as having a horse face. One of the biggest problems was is that if you know anyone who is from Germany, when they start learning English, they speak with a very thick, harsh accent, and he found her voice annoying. So after just a few months, he decided he didn't want her, so he was getting a divorce. But he didn't kill her. Interestingly enough, he set Anne up at an estate, well-to-do estate, and they became good friends. He didn't realize it beforehand, but after he divorced her, Anne knew how to play chess. And the king was fascinated with chess. So he would constantly go up to visit her, and they would just engage and talk like old friends and play board games. Ironically, out of everybody that I'm talking about during this time period, she was actually the last person standing. She actually outlived even Elizabeth. But after the divorce, he needed to find a new wife. And this time, he once again fell for lust. A very, very, very young woman caught his attention. Henry first noticed Catherine Howard when she was 16, serving as a lady-in-waiting for Jane Seymour. After Jane's death, obviously he was distracted, but during the point when he decided he was done with Anne, Catherine grew 2 years older, and she kind of grew into her body a little more, and man, did the king lust after her. The problem was, she was 18, he was 48, and Henry was no longer the Henry of his youth. Young, athletic, fit, handsome. Henry, by this point, was over 300 pounds. Now keep in mind, he was 5'6". So he literally was rounded in shape. Plus, to make matters worse, he had a oozing ulcer on his thigh. He suffered an injury when he was younger, and they didn't have good medical care. And so it was never treated well. So it basically stunk. And in fact, during this time period, it was said, you knew the king was coming by the smell. You smelt it before you saw him. Needless to say, She found him disgusting, but she wanted to be like, you know, not that I'm going to knock any young ladies, but if they have the chance to be a queen, I think they'll hold their nose and take one for the team. And yes, they did consummate the marriage, but they really didn't do it too much afterwards. Because she had her eyes on a young man, one of the aides in court, that was her age. And she got caught making out with him. Which is an act of treason! The kings can commit adultery, but not the queens. So she was put on trial, and she got her head cut off. Henry's last wife was more like what happens when, you know, the old people that are in retirement communities kind of get married after maybe, you know, each of their spouses died and they're just good friends, so they decide to get married. There was no lust. There was no sex. Both of them at this point was in their 50s. And that was ancient for that time period, which is ironic because I'm in my 50s and I feel literally like I did in my 30s. But again, life was harder back then. But most of their marriage involved her serving more like a nurse, taking care of the ever more and more aging, sickly king than anything. And interestingly enough, when Henry died, because he predeceased her, he actually granted on his death in his will a full annulment so she could go out and remarry again. So Henry gets a bad rap, but, you know, if you were on his side, he took care of you. But here's the thing. The church was created for him to get a son. That was its only purpose. They broke away from the Catholic Church, from the universality of the Catholic Church, and started going down the way of Protestantism. So as a result, the church was not based on dogma or theology. It was based on the guy who took it over. And now that he was dead, this would leave things up in the air. To make matters worse, 4 years before he died, Henry passed a law that resulted in the next decades in England literally being, bless you, like a pendulum, swinging back and forth between Protestantism and Calvinism. Catholicism. This law is known as the Act of Succession, ratified by Parliament in 1543. In this law, Henry laid down who would follow him and in what sequence. His son was his immediate heir, Edward. But Edward was sickly. So in the event that Edward died without producing an heir, Henry set in law something unprecedented in all of Europe. His daughter, a woman, would not just become queen, but would be sovereign, meaning she could rule. Of course, Mary was his oldest daughter, daughter of Catherine, the first Catherine, Catherine of Aragon. But by this point, Mary was getting up there in age. She was in her 30s. So in the event that Mary did not produce an heir, the next in line would be his daughter with Anne Boleyn, Elizabeth. And if something were to happen to Elizabeth,
either she died before she got a chance or she did not produce an heir, then any person within the bloodline of his sister, Margaret, would stay in the line of succession. So not only did he name two women specifically, but remember the whole reason why the Hundred Years' War started? Because the French basically said, no, we can't give it to Edward III because Edward III's claim comes through a woman. Well, now, the fourth in line would be descendants that passed through a woman. Why? Well, at this point, Henry didn't care about the Catholic rules. Henry didn't care about Catholic traditions. He was focused on keeping his bloodline on the throne. Dynasty before church. Questions? All right, well, let's see how the kids did. Religiously speaking. Edward would come to the throne as Edward VI. He would become king in 1547. And unfortunately, he would have a relatively short reign of under 6 years. When he became king, he was only 9 years old. So he would actually not be sovereign. His reign would be controlled by regents. And the king's council selected his uncle's family, the Seymours, or rather his uncle of the Seymours. And the interesting thing about the Seymours was that they were more Protestant than Catholic. They were Calvinists. So during his reign, Parliament began passing laws that changed the nature of the church. Now Henry allowed a lot of the Catholic traditions to remain, such as the Latin Mass, because Henry liked the Latin Mass. Well, during the reign of Edward VI, Latin was outlawed. All masses now would be in English. A prayer book. The original prayer book of the Church of England, written in Latin. The six articles. Well, during the reign of Edward VI, that would be printed only in English. So that way the people could read it. And, interestingly enough, the Church of England, the priests were allowed to get married. They abolished the requirements of celibacy for priests. So, religiously, Henry, even though he was in charge, kind of left the church like the Catholic Church. But now, suddenly, the pendulum is being pulled in the opposite direction. But as far as his reign goes, the easiest way to describe it is just with two words. It was chaotic. Scotland rebelled. It was very violent in its suppression. And the country was plagued with what today we would call an economic depression. So, other than changing the church, there was no significant reforms. Because obviously the regents were distracted by other things. But sadly, the young man would die in 1553 at the age of 15. Died of tuberculosis. Now, as he neared his deathbed, Edward, who was raised in the religion of his mother, and his mother was a Protestant, realized when he died, his half-sister Mary was legally his heir. She was a Catholic. She never hid her Catholicism. So a lot of the Protestants were terrified
that if she became ruler, she would grab the pendulum and swing it back strongly into the Catholic side. So his council attempted to nullify the act of succession. Now the funny thing is kings have a right to pass laws, and kings have a right to pass laws that undo laws of previous kings. So technically what they did was perfectly legal. Edward and his council passed a decree that nullified the act of succession. And in the place of Mary, they went to the end of the line. They skipped over Mary, they skipped over Elizabeth, and they went to one of the granddaughters of Henry's sister, a young woman by the name of Jane Grey. Jane Grey was a Protestant. So when Edward died, the king's council declared her to be queen. And she was queen for 9 days. Did any of you watch the coronation of Charles III? Not that I care about monarchies, but I watched it because I like history. And one of the big things that stood out was the fact that while the religious ceremony occurred in the church, it was mentioned by the commentators 7 times that Charles is not king until Parliament accepts him. That goes all the way back to the Magna Carta. So, even though Edward and his council named her heir, the only way for her to effectively become queen was Parliament to endorse it. But Parliament did not. Parliament rejected her claim. The reason being was twofold. One, there were still many members of Parliament who were Catholic and wanted England to go back to Catholicism. But the MPs, the members of Parliament, also recognized that the people of England loved Mary as much as they had loved her mother, Catherine of Aragon. They adored her. They knew nothing about Jane Grey. So the Parliament was terrified that there actually would be an uprising, that people would take to the streets and burn half of London down, demanding that Mary become queen. So Parliament rejected. They found her guilty of treason, and she would be beheaded. Which would pave the way for Mary to ascend to the throne. Mary would become queen in 1553. She had her coronation in the church, and she was ratified by Parliament. Now she had a love-hate relationship with her father, but she absolutely adored her mother. So Mary, in many ways, had the stubbornness of Henry, but had the religiosity of Catherine. So when she comes to the throne, one of the first things she realizes, she needs to produce an heir, an offspring, to prevent Elizabeth from becoming queen. Because Elizabeth, nobody knew what her religion was. She didn't advertise it.
But on the off chance that she was a Protestant, Mary needed to have a Catholic baby. So she looked around and she found a bachelor that would help her re-secure Catholicism for England. She selected her second cousin. Definitely wasn't a first cousin. Second. I'm trying to do the math. Second cousin, who was king of Spain, Philip II. Now, ironically, Philip would travel to London, would take part in a marriage ceremony, and would consummate the marriage. But shortly thereafter, he went back to Madrid because Spain was in control of Central and South America. And by the 1550s, the Mita system is in place. Some of the plantations are being set up. And just boatload after boatload after boatload of wealth is flowing to Spain. England was not even a third-rate country. It was a tiny island. Poor. He had no desire to stay in London. So even though they did what married people are supposed to do to make it official, he bailed shortly thereafter. Now, sadly, Mary wanted a child as much as her father did. And within a few months after the marriage, it was announced that the queen was with child. But unfortunately, she would have a false pregnancy. Now, in case you may know this, women have tremendous mental control over their bodies, more so than men do. And sometimes women can believe they are pregnant so much that they can begin showing physical signs, such as the period stops and starts doing some fat and water retention in the belly, cramps. So she literally believed she was with child. Unfortunately, 3 months later, when her body normalized and it was realized she was in fact not with child, suddenly it became a national matter. Because now we have a Catholic king whose husband does not want to sleep with her anymore, who does not have child. So this means the clock is ticking. The moment she dies, the throne is going to pass to Elizabeth. And what's Elizabeth's religion? Like I said, we don't know. But to pave the way, Mary would attempt to do as much damage to Protestantism as possible. She not only had the pendulum swing back into the Catholic side, she grabbed it with both hands and gave it all the yank that she could. Every single Protestant law that Edward passed was nullified. So, no more marriage for priests. Priests have to be celibate. The Latin Mass is back. She actually ordered the collection plate. Alms were to be collected again. England was once again to begin transporting donations to Rome. Everything was going in that direction. To make matters worse, she would unleash an inquisition of sorts. She began openly persecuting Protestant nobles. And during her reign, she earned the nickname Bloody Mary, which is what that adult beverage is named after. She reveled in the executions of Protestants. There were beheadings,
There were stonings. But one of the things that she usually attended with regularity was burning at the stake. She liked watching Protestants, particularly Protestant women, go up in flames.
While she would sit back on a nice comfy chair with an umbrella over her while she sipped tea and had crumpets.
Additionally, over 800 nobles would be exiled and their estates would be seized. If you remember, as I mentioned, Henry did the same thing to the Catholic churches and the Catholic monasteries. Well, Elizabeth would take the Protestant land, sell them, and send those donations to Rome to try to make up for what her father did.
She would also acknowledge papal authority over the church. So whereas her dad was the head of the church, she says, no, the Pope is. And as if that was not bad enough, she dragged England into a war against France.
But by doing so, she would end up losing the last English territory on the continent.
The only English territory left after the Hundred Years' War was the city of Calais. Well, the French king went in there and conquered that and refused to pay her any compensation.
Unfortunately, because she spent all her time on this Catholic crusade and getting England involved in stupid wars, the economic problems of her brother continued and only got worse during her reign.
It got so bad, she had to suspend the currency. The coins, which were once based on specie, became essentially lead coins, and lead had no value.
So the only way to curb inflation was her to suspend all money and she would issue a new currency. Which only caused all the prices to go through the roof because now nobody has money. In the end, people began to resent her. I would go so far as to say hate in some circumstances. And there were rumors abound of a potential revolution. But before a single person could die, she died. She would spend the last few months of her life suffering unimaginable pain, and she would end up dying of ovarian cancer. Now we are 12 years beyond the death of Henry VIII. His son, his thirdborn, is dead, and now his firstborn is dead. The last child standing is, ironically, today regarded by the English as still one of their best rulers ever, Elizabeth I. She would have a long reign of 45 years, making her one of the most powerful queens in Western civilization. Unlike Elizabeth II, who reigned, Elizabeth I ruled. She was sovereign. And what she realized after seeing the craziness of her half-brother and the craziness of her half-sister, it would be Elizabeth who ultimately would finish the English Reformation by realizing something. Both worshipped God, both recognized Jesus, Both read the Bible. Both embraced Scripture. So if both Catholics and Protestants are essentially doing the same thing, why are we going to be either or? One of the things that makes her great was she recognized something our politicians today don't recognize. The need to compromise. Doesn't have to be all or nothing. You can give a little to get a little. So what does she do? Well, one of the first acts upon becoming queen was she passed a law that became known as the Reformation Bill. Reformation, of course, being reform. And what she would do was find compromise. On one hand, communion would be by law designated to be a physical connection with God. So by taking communion, you are connecting with God. But you know what she doesn't say? She doesn't say, is it transubstantiation or is it consubstantiation? She never in the law defines, is it actually the body and blood or is it just a spiritual representation? But instead, she ordered every Christian to get communion. So notice, she didn't get caught up in the stupidity. She also says that priests do not have to wear the Catholic tunic. So long as they look presentable when they go to Mass, and as long as the people accept it, whatever the priest wears is fine. By the way, in terms of marriage, she said that also is up to the congregation. If the people of the church want to allow their priest to get married, they can have a married priest. If they don't want to, they don't have to. It's up to the people. And by the way, how do we know the people are going to obey these rules? Well, she also passed another act of supremacy in which she named herself as the head of the church. Mary rejected it. She brought it back. So now her law is God's law. And you know what she decides to do with that power? She removes the harsh punishments that were put in the law by Edward against Catholics and by Mary against Protestants. She basically says, if you want to be a Catholic, be a Catholic. If you want to be a Protestant, be a Protestant. The government isn't going to punish you. And finally, she passes an act of uniformity, which would blend Catholic in Protestant traditions together in the Mass. It was said that during her reign, if you were a Christian and you went to Mass and you were a Catholic, you absolutely believed you were in a Catholic Mass. Because there was English and there was Latin. But if you were a Protestant, you thought you were in a Protestant Mass. Because again, she didn't care about either or. Let's bring everyone together. Let's be uniform. United we stand, divided we fall. And then lastly, she used her position of the church to make all of the rules for the church going forward, including the prayer book, which is still used in Anglican churches and Episcopalian churches today, and another document called the 39 Articles. And like everything I said, there's some elements of Protestantism in there, there's some elements of Catholicism, but she intentionally left it vague. In other words, the old saying goes, in the eye of the beholder. So she allowed the reader to read into it whatever they wanted.
The big thing, though, is she avoided fanaticism. She didn't want people being called heretics by their neighbors. She didn't want to see English citizens burned at the stake because of some fanatic religious interpretation. And so in the end, she was able to do something that no other ruler on the European continent was able to do. She would actually avoid a religious war, as we're going to see, which would break out in every other country in Europe. Why? She would allow people to have their own opinions. Ironically, our rulers today, our leaders, we don't have rulers, we have leaders. They could learn a lot of things about her. Particularly the Democrats that only do Democrat stuff, or the Republicans that only do Republican stuff. It's not about us versus them. If we're all in the same boat, we got to work together as a team. And Elizabeth is an example of one of those few leaders in history that were able to unite all her people because she allowed them to have their own opinions. So long as they didn't hurt their neighbors, they could be whatever they wanted to be. And to bring it full circle, this is the reason why even today, people of the Great Britain acknowledge her to be one of the greatest rulers in their entire history. She was not divisive in any way, shape, or form. The people during her lifetime loved her, and the people who came after still love her today. Questions? All right. Well, unfortunately, like I just said, not everyone would get it right. And all throughout the rest of Europe, there would be division, divisiveness. Because the Catholic Church would decide, after several decades, after Luther made his stand, to respond to this protest and reform movement. And how would they do it? Well, by launching their own reformation, a counter-reformation. Attempts to destroy Protestantism. Now, the hope was, let's rejuvenate the Catholic Church. Let's get people going back to church. Let's get people excited about going to church. But ironically, is once the people who were fanatical about Catholicism were all fired up about going back to their church, they were as fired up as the people who were fired up about being Protestants. And unfortunately, when you get people and fanatically devoted to their faiths, there goes the ability to compromise. But why did it take decades for the church to act? Well, it wasn't that the people didn't realize the church was corrupt. We've said this. We've seen this. Going back to Marsalis of Padua, 300 years, people realized the church was corrupt, that the church was not doing what it was supposed to do. But the problem was, is what do you do about it? So, we've had a problem that's been a problem almost for my entire life. Illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants has been a problem since the 1970s. When there were a group of people called the Boat People came over to the United States in the wake of the Vietnam War, particularly the Cambodian genocide. And so the question, what are you going to do with these people, has been omnipresent in my 5 decades plus on Earth. And of course, it's only been exacerbated during the presidency of our current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, who has let somewhere between 8 and 10 million people come across the border illegally.
But the question is still the same. What are we going to do with them?
The politicians don't want to fix the problem or can't fix the problem because there are opinions that vary. You have some people that want to make them citizens. You have some that want to give them amnesty. You have some that only want to give selective amnesty. And you have some that want to deport them all. And no one is willing to compromise. So nothing's ever going to get done. The politicians are still going to use it as an issue. So Donald Trump's using it as an issue in his campaign. Joe Biden's not even talking about it, although Joe Biden really doesn't talk about anything unless it's on a script. But all of the things that the Protestants were talking about, the people in the Catholic Church knew were true. But they, like what happened with Clement in his refusal to give Henry an annulment, if they acknowledge it, that means you're wrong. And they were stuck in the mindset, my way or the highway. Complicating things was that people who were making suggestions on how to react to Protestantism had various opinions. It was a full-blown spectrum. For example, Erasmus. It was Erasmus who, in Textus Receptus, first pointed out that the Catholic Church could be wrong, because their interpretation of the Bible could be wrong. Now, Erasmus didn't say it had to be one way or another, but Erasmus just wanted to have a discussion. This is a serious matter. If the church is telling people the wrong things, they're going to go to hell. So let's be adults. Let's have a conversation. But no one did. Luther took out the errors that Erasmus pointed out as justification of the church's infallibility. That they're not infallible, that they do make mistakes. But ironically, even though Erasmus pointed it out, he never left the church. He remained a devoted Catholic until he died. So Erasmus is kind of in the middle. On the left side, the more liberal side, you had another example, Sir Thomas More. Sir Thomas More was, for a brief time, Henry VIII's tutor, and he would also serve as prime minister. In dealing with the division within the church, Thomas More in 1516 wrote a book called Utopia. Now there are sections of Utopia in your reader. If you're going to do the third round of extra credit for exam number 3. Have any of you ever read Utopia? I'll be honest with you, it's one of the few books in literature that, even though it was written in the 16th century, it's readable. It's not that hard. It's an easy story. And in many ways, it's like Gulliver's Travels. It's an adventure tale. Does anyone know what utopia means? The actual meaning of the word utopia from its Greek origins. How is utopia interpreted today?
Perfect city.
What? A perfect place, perfect city, yeah. Ironically, the ancient Greeks, recognized a simple truism. Is perfection obtainable on earth? No, there is no place that's perfect. So the actual meaning of the word utopia from its root origins is no place, because no place is perfect. But in Utopia, Thomas More tells a story about a sea captain that is shipwrecked on an island in the middle of the ocean, and he enters a magical realm of peace and harmony. harmony is achieved because everyone on the island believes the same exact thing. There is no difference of opinion. But the arrival of the stranger, who is an outsider, with different opinions, caused a tremendous amount of controversy. So in the end, Moore paints a story where the perfect society, where everyone thought the same in its reaction to this new person and these new ideas, decided not to kill him, but to converse. And take some of the things that he said as alternatives and put them into practice in order to make utopia better than it was. So people who thought like Moore during this time were like basically saying, look, let's talk to the Protestants. Let's talk to them. Let's have conversations. Let's recognize that some of their criticisms are right. And if they're right, we'd be stupid not to fix the problems. Or you could be like my friend. One of my friends. Effing lazy bastard. Go to his house. 7 years ago. I go into his bathroom upstairs, because he only has a bathroom upstairs, and I notice, it was raining out, that water was pouring in, dripping, along his wall. And I go and tell him, I'm like, Steve, you got water pouring in your basement. I mean, in your ceiling. He's like, yeah, whatever, I'll deal with it. I'll get to it someday. Well, I went back this past weekend. Guess what I noticed? The walls were still stained. He hadn't done anything, except now he let it go so long that the plaster started coming out. And me being the pain in the ass that I am, I take one of my keys and I kind of pull back some of the plaster, and what do I see in there? Black mold. So I'm like, dude, you got mold in your house. And he's like, yeah, whatever, I'll get to it. So, don't be like Steve. If there's a problem, fix it. Because if you don't fix it, it's only going to get worse. That's what Moore was saying. But the problem is that the vast majority of the Catholics did not want to acknowledge what the Protestants were saying. Because their church told them differently. So, Erasmus is in the middle. Moore is over on the left. Let's go to the extreme right. And for that, I'm going to give you an example of Cardinal Jimenez. Cardinal Jimenez was the Grand Inquisitor of Spain during the reign of Ferdinand and Isabella. He oversaw the end of the Reconquista, when Catholic Spain reconquered the Iberian Peninsula. They did so by driving out all of the Jews and all of the Muslims that were living in their country. And they did so by the Spanish Inquisition. Anybody know anything about the Inquisition? And we're not talking about the Monty Python skit. Although no one does expect the Spanish Inquisition. But we're not going to throw him in the comfy chair and poke him with the soft cushion. Not going to do that. Anybody know anything about the real Inquisition? Well, very simple. If your neighbor, if your loved one, mother, father, spouse, brother, sister, thought you were not true in your devotion to the Catholic Church, they would report you. And then church guards
would come and seize you. And they would drag you down into one of the church's dungeons. And there you would be told the crimes in which you were accused. And you were given an opportunity to confess. If you confessed your sins, you could be forgiven by the church. But if you refused, you would be physically tortured until you confessed or died, whichever came first. I am fascinated by the Inquisition because of the wonderful torture devices that were used. Any of you know about the rack? What's the rack? Yeah, so you get tied down on a flat table and your arms are tied up at the wrists and your ankles are tied up and you're put on a device where the rope on your wrists are cranked, thus stretching you and stretching you and stretching you to the point where like your joints pop and all of like the sinew and all of the ligaments all tear. And essentially, it's very, very excruciating. And in some instances, they can put so much pressure on you that not only could it possibly rip out your limbs, but it also could cause your spine to separate. How about the pear? No? The pear was something that they could use one of two ways. They could use it against men by putting it in their mouth, or they could use it against women by putting it in, well, another spot. And what it was a steel pear-shaped device that had a screw in it. And so what they would do is they would turn the screw, and like petals, it would open up, getting wider and wider and wider. If it's in your mouth, it's going to cause your jaw to dislocate. If it's in, well, lady parts, it's going to do other types of damage. The other thing that they had was the horse. It was like a triangle-shaped board that was kind of like a sawhorse. So it had legs. But it would be shaped like this. And what they would do is they would put a person, so that way he was sitting on it like a horse, with the sharp point obviously going up on the backside. And there would be similar cranks to the rack that would be tied around the ankles, and they would twist them. So it would pull you down and down and down and down. Excruciating pain! Which would, of course, force people to confess their sins before being permanently disfigured. Well, it was Cardinal Hymenus who came up with this system because he was always on the lookout for heretics, for the Jews or the Muslims who attempted to remain in Spain and did not truly convert. So, you have opinions that are about talking, you have opinions that involve torture. It's no wonder why the church took decades to respond. Because what do you actually do about it? What's going to fix the problem? What are you going to do about the millions of illegals in here? You know, same thing. How do you fix it? Well, the man who would begin the Catholic Counter-Reformation became Pope in 1534. And he would remain Pope for the next 15 years. Pope Paul was a scholar, an intellectual. And he had read the works of many of the Protestants, as well as the works of many of the people in the Catholic Church, arguing for one position or another on what to do about the Protestantism. And he decided
that one of the best ways to deal with it was to take action. He first realized that one of the reasons why Protestantism spread was because no one did anything about it. None of his predecessors. And in fact, they only exacerbated the situation. So first and foremost, he would try to restore the integrity of the papacy. So that way, once again, people looked at the not just the man who was the pope, but the position of the pope with respect. But that was not easy, because many of his predecessors were corrupt. And he realized that some of the things the Protestants were saying was truthful. So he had to fix the problems. So what does he do? Well, he took up some of Luther's claims. Some of the biggest problems with the Catholic Church. Indifference. No one cared. It's funny, being a historian, you know, I see things play out in our time. And I'm always reminded of other events that occurred in the past. And of course, I look to them to try to make sense of what's going on today, because history always repeats itself. And one of the things that I find most common is that people just don't give a shit. People today, they don't care that our country's screwed up. We elect politicians that don't care that our country's screwed up. Because to do something about it takes effort. And most people are lazy. So they allow it, like my buddy Steve. They just allow it to continue. So what does Pope Paul start doing? He starts calling out the people who are corrupt and aren't doing anything about it. He starts naming names. He attacks corruption. He begins telling the cardinals, look, if you're going to be a cardinal, do your damn job. Police the bishops. Make sure the bishops are doing their job. And bishops, police the priests. Make sure you're not using the position to get rich or to get fat. Save people's souls. Because the church isn't about making money. The church is supposed to be that vehicle that helps believers ascend into heaven. But he didn't just act. No. He wanted other opinions. So he appoints a commission. And this commission goes through all of the claims by all of the Protestants. Claim by claim. And they realize that all of the stuff that the church has been doing since the Babylonian captivity, acting like a Ponzi scheme, is the root of the problem. Because money corrupts. So, no more buying church offices. No more holding multiple offices. If you're going to be a priest, you're going to be a bishop, you're going to be a cardinal, do your job. If not, you're gone. The commission also says, like Wycliffe said, like Marcellus said way back centuries before, that in order to continue the reforms, you need a church-wide council. That the church should not always be top-down. That you should get bottom-up. To get there, though, Paul removed cardinals. He purged the College of Cardinals. And he replaced the corrupt ones with eminent scholars. People who were actually believed in their roles. Ironically, it started a trend that would completely change the course of the Catholic Church. You know, to this day, the popes that we've had going back 200-300 years, every single one has been an intellectual, has been a scholar, that has been well-read. not someone who happens to be connected to a king. It all goes back to Pope Paul III. He also would create foot soldiers to spearhead the Counter-Reformation. He recognized a group known as the Society of Jesus, who are commonly referred to as the Jesuits. The Jesuits were created literally to be like the special forces of the Catholic Church. The Jesuits were founded by Ignatius of Loyola, who himself was a military commander. So the Jesuits were created to be literally like a military force. Loyola was the general, the Pope would be the commander-in-chief. And within the army of Jesuits, there would be different specialized divisions who would be charged with certain tasks. The biggest things that the Jesuits were supposed to do was serve as defenders of the faith. They would infiltrate the world. They would fan out on a global level. They would come in the guise as preachers. Some would be teachers. Holy Cross, founded by the Jesuits. They would serve as confessors. But they also would serve as diplomats and spies. They would go out and observe, particularly places where Protestantism was rumored to have taken root. And they would find out who, for instance, started it. And they would report it back. And then the soldiers of the church would go out and get them to stop the spread of Protestantism. The Jesuits were largely responsible for the conversion of all of the native peoples in Central and South America to Catholicism. They went out and they destroyed the religions of the Aztecs and the Incas and all of the other tribes. They also saved France from going Protestant. They saved Poland and managed to protect Southern Germany. Pope Paul would also create what technically is known as the Holy Office. Although the job of the Holy Office was to be the Roman Inquisition. So when we talk about the scientific revolution, and we learn about a guy by the name of Galileo Galilei, he would actually be dragged in and have to appear before the Holy Office, accused of heresy, for saying that the earth went around the sun. Questions? All right, the final bit, because we're almost done, is the Churchwide Council. After working for a decade, implement all of these reforms, the last significant act in terms of Pope Paul's involvement in the Counter-Reformation was he called for a church-wide gathering, the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent would meet three times over the next 20 years. And it would be the Council of Trent that would reform the rules of the church to embrace this new Counter-Reformation. At its core, it was the direct response to Protestantism. Ironically, though, Pope Paul had already attacked many of the claims of Luther. He already dealt with them.
So what the Council of Trent would end up doing is essentially saying, we've implemented some reforms, now here's the law. This is the way it's going to be. They would take the approach of Jimenez, not more. And they would basically begin making mandates that it's up to the individuals of the church to police themselves. But of course, if they deviate from the rules of the church, that's what the Holy Office is all about. So, to be a Catholic is hard. But to be a real Catholic, you have to follow all the rules. So what were some of the rules? What were some of the things that they no longer would allow? Multiple offices. You couldn't be a cardinal in two cities. You only had one job. You couldn't buy an office. If you wanted to become a bishop, you actually had to enroll. You had to go to university. You had to first become a priest. Then, if you worked hard, then possibly you could rise to bishop, similarly to the rank of cardinal. No more secular pursuits. No more businesses. No more whorehouses. No more gambling dens. The church was supposed to be the vehicle for salvation. Oh, no more selling of indulgences. That's another example I got in my notes. No more little scraps of paper. Okay, I gotta go quick. All right. To make sure that all of these rules would be enforced, well, bishops were basically told, if you want to remain a bishop, your job is to oversee your bishoprics. You actually have to go to every single church. You have to make sure the priests are doing their job. You have to check the books. You have to talk to the people that attend the parishes. You couldn't just be like a noble, sitting around wearing silk and getting fat and being drunk all the time. And that was it. There was going to be no compromise. These are the rules. We got rid of the big abuses that the Protestants said, and that's it. Some of the things they kept were the things that Luther criticized. For instance, good works. Luther, in his 95 Theses, said, you shouldn't have to do something to be a Christian. You shouldn't have to, you know, go to CCD. You shouldn't have to, you know, do confession. You shouldn't have to. You should just have faith. Well, the church said no. If the church tells you to do something, you still have to do it. All seven sacraments are still sacred. So you have to be baptized when you are a child. You have to be raised in the church. You have to be married within the church. You have to follow the church rules of marriage. You have to get last rites and so forth. Masses are going to be in Latin. None of this. English and French and stuff. No. Going to a Catholic chants. Catholic Mass, you're going to go and deal with what's known as the Tridentine Mass. And all of the other things, the saints, the pilgrimages, the cult of the Virgin, pre-celibacy, all of those things are going to stay. And if you don't like it, don't be a Catholic. And lastly, the Council of Trent would end its work by acknowledging that their work is done. This was the democracy. The democracy is over. Now the Pope is in charge. So it's going to be forever top down. Now here's the thing. They actually did get rid of some of the things the Protestants wanted, but not all. And there would be no other compromise. So the line is drawn in the sand. The church was no longer going to bend. The Protestants were unwilling to bend. And when you have two sides that are unwilling to talk to one another, the outcome is war. And we'll deal with that on Thursday. Questions? All right, so I have homework. I got to finish those tests for the people that did the makeups, and I'll release the grades. You have homework. Papers, 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 papers. And start getting ready for exam number 3, which will not be this weekend. Might be next weekend, though. Just saying. Bye. Why not?